and welcome to this edition of the DMZ America podcast. It is Wednesday, November 9th, 2022. I'm Scott Stantis coming to you from the right.
And I'm Ted Rall coming to you from the left.
And how can I put this? We were wrong. We were wrong. We were very, 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 very wrong. How wrong were we? Well, it's very, 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 very wrong. That's us.
Is that an actual song?
No, I just made it
from like a Broadway show.
I just made it up off the top of my head.
Oh my God. So if this cartooning thing doesn't work out, oh wait, that happened.
Yeah, it really has. Ted and I made predictions on the last podcast. You can go back and listen to them. And
we wish you wouldn't.
Yes, we are going to destroy it in an unexpected fire, which is weird because it's
Edward
on the internet.
Snowden, I know you listen. You can probably do something about this for us.
Yeah,
you know what
hacky
I mean?
Hacky. Yeah, we were. I was listening to the polls, and I think Ted was too. And I think we were swayed, and just listening to people and looking at what was happening around the country, we assumed the Republicans would have a wave. The Democratic message seemed to be falling apart. Well, son of a bitch. That's not how things turned out, Ted.
Well, I mean, I'm going to push back against that just because I'm a weasel. Look, here's the thing. We were right about the results. We were wrong about the spread. The House of Representatives is going to be roughly plus five in favor of the GOP. The Senate could be barely GOP by one vote. It could be even again. It's all going to come down to the runoff election in Georgia and the surprising race in Nevada. And it's going to be divided government, and all the things that we said that were going to happen are still going to happen. I mean, you're still going to, and we'll talk about that in the second segment, is my understanding. But
yes,
but those things, it's still, the results are fundamentally the same. And one thing that you have to remember is Republicans always declare a mandate, even if they don't have one.
Yeah, yeah.
So they will declare a mandate. And in fairness, they did win. And there are some spots that, there are some places that I would, if I were a Democrat, I would not be feeling good about. Ohio, my home state, where carpetbagging douche J.D. Vance defeated Tim Ryan, who was a strong Democratic candidate, by more points than were expected. This was a guy who was expected to lose just about 6 weeks ago. He closed the gap and then exceeded that. Ohio is now officially a red state, I would say.
Oh, deep red.
The state house, the Republicans consolidated seats in the Ohio state legislature. I would look at New York's governor race. I know some people aren't that interested in it, but I think it's an important barometer of sort of weak Democratic candidates. I mean, Kathy Hochul, the incumbent former lieutenant governor who's been governor for a year following the resignation of Andrew Cuomo, is currently with 93% of the vote in, up by five, but her challenger, Lee Zeldin from Eastern Long Island, where I used to live in Suffolk County, his votes in his home district haven't yet been counted. So that's going to be a much tighter race. She wins, but she's going to win maybe by one point. I mean, that is incredible for deep blue New York. She should have trounced him by 10 or 15 points. Lee Zeldin, extremist. He's a far right wing lunatic. And he's kind of a very unpleasant man to, and it's just amazing to me that that this happened. So it's not all good news for the Democrats, although for sure they staunched the bleeding. There's no question about that. I was expecting a bloodbath of like a 25 seat victory for the Republicans. Instead, it's going to be like five. It's not a bloodbath, but it's a red tide. It's a like a lethargic.
It's a lapping along the shoreline.
Sure. Yeah. It's a wimpy. Yeah. It's certainly not a tsunami of any sorts, but it's not a blue tsunami either.
But we're going to talk about.
The speaker's gavel moves from Pelosi to McCarthy. I mean, that's the main takeaway here. We don't know. The Senate's still up in the air. And I guess the big news is that election nights, kind of in the age of absentee, massive numbers of absentee ballots and tons of early votes that can't be counted until election night. Basically, election nights are boring. You really don't learn anything for like days or even weeks.
No, you kind of have to wonder how they did it. You look at the returns from, I was thinking about this last night. You look, because someone brought up the old style returns. Remember the NBC or CBS had the chalkboard, huge chalkboard behind like Walter Cronkite or Huntley and Brinkley, and they'd write in the results as they were coming in from, those elections were still called those that night. I mean, even the Nixon Kennedy race in 1960 was, I think it was announced like
it went late though.
It went very late, and Nixon conceded, I think, like at 5 a.m, 6 in the, it was an all-nighter, but they still had a result that day within 24 hours of the election, which was curious. But you have to remember, four of those elections in the early TV times, 52, 56, 60, 64, three of the four of those were blowouts. So, I mean, you knew who was winning by, by bedtime.
Sure.
The 60 race was a little different until Cook County came in with 10,000 more votes than there were voters in the county. But, who can explain that?
Well,
going down the line, looking at, I said, look at Arizona as like the place to look, because it's fairly independent, as you know. I mean, it's elected mavericks. But in all seriousness, right now, as it stands right now, it looks like Hobbs will defeat Lake for governor. It's a narrow, narrow, narrow win, but it's still a win for the Democrats. Kelly still stays as the senator. There is a complete and utter nutbag. I mean, full-blown crazy guy running for Secretary of State, a Republican. He lost by a significant amount. There's a couple of things to look at of what happened across the nation here, Ted, and it's fascinating. It happened in New York, happened in Arizona, happened here. I mean, happened all across the nation. And that it happened in Georgia. And that's ballot splitting, which we've never seen. I don't know that we've seen this much in an election. I think those are numbers that are going to have to be broken down and looked at. But if you look at those races, like I said, in Georgia and in other places, the numbers like Kemp won fairly, Governor Kemp of Georgia won fairly handily over Stacey Abrams. And maybe later segment, we'll talk about why Democrats continue to renominate people who lost.
Yes. Well, hello. We're looking at you, Beto O'Rourke.
Yes, we're looking at you, Stacey Abrams. I mean, they love her, and she doesn't win.
Well, Stacey Abrams, technically, they don't call them election denialists if they're Democrats, but she's kind of an election denialist, right? Waving the bloody shirt, she claimed that she had actually won and been cheated by Brian Kemp. So it was time to, get even and have a fair race. And this time she was really going to win. She ran a terrible campaign. But Brian Kemp was very impressive. I mean, he went against the headwinds of not having support of Donald Trump in a conservative state. He was going against a darling of the national media, Stacey Abrams, who also received a lot of outside money. The DNC cared about her race a lot. So,
I'm sorry. I've been in politics for 50 years, Ted. I mean, that's, so half a century, I have some experience to draw from. The person who lost last time, unless they lost by a fraction,
like Nixon in 1960.
There you go. Frankly, Al Gore should have run again in 2004, by the way.
He might have won. Yeah.
I think he would have. I mean, John Kerry damn near did. If John Kerry had carried Ohio, he would have won.
Well, Ohio was kind of a cheat, right? Ohio was the Secretary of State. And there's a great article by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. that appeared in Rolling Stone that kind of showed the campaign by Ohio Secretary of State, who was a Republican, to suppress Democratic votes in Ohio very successfully. And mainly what they did is they took the old-fashioned, voting machines with the switches, and moved them out of Democratic, like particularly black inner cities, like in Toledo, Dayton, places like that, and moved them out to reassigned them out to white areas where they were. So therefore, what they did is they created these crazy lines. In Ohio in 2004, in the national election, it was not uncommon for Black people to wait 12 hours to vote. And the weather was bad and they were outside and a lot of them gave up and didn't vote.
Well, the other thing they did, and the difference between Pennsylvania and Ohio, and this was, I think, as much of a factor as anything, is Ohio had an anti-gay marriage amendment on the ballot, along with the presidential race between
which would never pass now,
John Kerry.
But which would never pass.
Yeah. Well, that's what was interesting is that's where polling. We're gonna have to jump on to that. The polling then in Ohio was that people would be asked. They say, "Are you going to vote for the anti-gay marriage thing?" And they go, "Of course not. That would be of course not. What, me? I'm open-minded." But they got into the voting booth and they voted for it, and it did pass.
Right.
Which was later found to be unconstitutional. But don't let that get in the way of you folks. So I'm trying to look across the country. Here's the takeaway. And Ted, you wrote a column which was very Ted-ish many years ago.
Well, as one expects.
I think it followed the 2004 election. And if you look at these maps across the country, and it just shows that the divide between the urban voter and the rural voter is wider than it has ever been. I mean, you see these, I mean, state after state after state after state, where, you know, the cities clearly are voting blue, the rest of the state votes red. And you wrote a column. Do you remember this time you wrote, because it had to get some blowback, where you said that, you know, okay, I'm going to say it. The urban areas are better. We're smarter. We dress better. We have better food. That part was tongue in cheek, but it really was just saying, and your takeaway was that the urban voter was just smarter and just, I mean, you couldn't believe that Bush got reelected. I think was kind of the kernel of that column. I mean, do you still feel that way? I mean, it seems to be borne out. I mean, it seems to be that the divide is becoming wider and wider.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say this because, you know, you're my best friend, but I mean, and you're conservative, but I mean, I think, you know, I do stand by it. I mean, studies have shown that Republican voters, rural voters, red state voters tend to be have a lower level of educational attainment. When they're asked basic questions about, for example, what the First Amendment is about, or, you know, what the capital of their state is, they're less likely to be able to answer those questions. You know, I think it is true that conservative voters in the United States tend to be less educated and less informed than Democratic voters. And, you know, I'm sorry to say that's the case. But I mean, even just in terms of personal experience, you know, I mean, I have spent a lot of time in Red America. I grew up in what is now Red America in southwestern Ohio. And you know, I'm always amazed. I mean, I hear Democrats say things that are stupid and not true all the time. But the volume, the pitch, and the frequency and the quantity of the stupidity is even thicker, I think, on the other side, I think.
Well, I think that, you know, how do you approach your politics? I think Ted and I would be safe to say we, you know, there's always a percentage mix. I say Ted and I would probably say 75-80% rational and 20-25% emotional. Mine's probably more so than Ted's. I'd say in the red counties and in the red part of the world, it's probably that's flipped. 80% is emotional. You know, it's and it may even be responding in a way into a thing that they can't really quantify, which is, I mean, and it's because it's tough to quantify, even if you pay a whole lot of attention, which you and I, Ted and I, are paid to do. And that is, you know, they are against us. They don't like you. You know, the you know, and it can be immigrants. That can be people of color. It can be Democrats. It can be liberals. Are all out to get you. I had a frantic email last night, Ted, about midnight from a friend of mine in Australia saying, "What is wrong with you people? How do you get so many people to vote against their own self-interests?" And that's I think that's really the most glaring part of Trump America, if you will, is that they are more, those people feel so marginalized. And they have been, frankly, the Democratic Party has done a shitty job at representing them and, you know, supposedly being their heroes or their champions, and they've done a terrible job. So, you know, now we're looking at, you know, going forward, I don't know that this rift is ever going to change. It's going to change anytime soon. It's a dangerous rift because it doesn't say, you know, we're united, we're going to do stuff. You know, it's funny. You do talk about how Republicans, you know, if they win by two votes, they're going to say, there is a mandate. Democrats right. do the exact opposite, say, well, the time to reach across the aisle is now.
And I'm like, what?
Yeah. And I'm with Ted on this one. I don't understand Democrats at this point. How many times are you going to reach across the aisle to the alligator? You know, how many times are you going to, you know, it just doesn't make any sense now. You have to step forward and say, we got a mandate. Here we go.
Yeah, there's no point. I mean, Scott, I do have to push back a little bit. I mean, you sort of brought up the sort of Thomas Frank, what's the matter with Kansas argument? You know, like, why do so many poor and working class people vote Republican, right, basically? And even though they're the party of big business, not that Democrats aren't also the party of big right. business, but different big businesses, maybe.
Thank you, Hillary.
But yes, exactly. But I mean, I think I'm just going to say, I don't think there's anything wrong with voting against your narrow parochial self-interest, and liberals do it too. And let me explain what I mean. So like, for example, many liberals who vote Democratic are well off, like say the Clintons. And yet they want higher taxes for themselves. You know, supporting higher taxes is obviously goes against your narrow self, your personal self-interest. But, you know, liberal Democrats vote for that. Liberal Democrats in New York City, where I live, just approved a pair of ballot initiatives that I kind of called the woke referenda, which basically adds a preamble to the city charter that says that the creation and establishment and encouragement of equity to redress past grievances and past wrongs done to minority groups has to become a priority of city policy, and also appoints an equity czar. Now, in the interest of full transparency, I voted no on both of these initiatives because the wording was so vague as to be meaningless. Nobody defines what equity means. Nobody says what grievances and justice means. It's all smushy. And, you know, considering that we have a mayor right now, Eric Adams, who is deep into nepotism and rewarding his posse with you know, well-paid no-show jobs.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, he's horrible. You know, so I'm like, kind of like, well, this could be the kind of thing that a corrupt mayor like Eric Adams could abuse and, you know, basically line the pockets of he and his friends. So, but the point is, the people who voted for the equity provisos in New York, they're liberal Democrats. They voted for Biden overwhelmingly. And, you know, most of them are white. Most New York voters are white. So they voted against their self-interest because it literally means that they and members of their race are going to be less likely to get city employment, for example, or to be prioritized in city policies going forward. They voted against their self-interest because they're trying to make a stand against racism and systemic racism and historical racism. So, I mean, there's lots of ways to vote against your self-interest, and I don't know that they're necessarily bad. And you could argue that poor people who vote Republican they think it's more important for the United States to be a military superpower than it is for them to do well economically, or maybe they think it's more important that abortion be banned because they want to save the lives of unborn children more than they care about moving out of the trailer park. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's like voting against your narrow self-interest is sometimes just called integrity.
Yeah, I think you're giving too much credit to the American voter. I got to be honest, but
not something I do normally.
No, I know this. Hey, listen, we're going to wrap this segment up right now, and we're going to go to and talk about the surprises and the trends that maybe most of you out there hadn't thought or considered. And there's a handful that are this is fascinating, and we're going to talk about it in the next segment. I'm Scott Stannis, coming to you from the right.
I'm Ted Rall, coming to you from the left.
And the DMZ America podcast. We'll be back in just a moment. Attitude. And we're back to DMZ America, the podcast. Unless there's DMZ America, there's something else, but this is the podcast. I'm Scott Stantis. I'll be coming to you from the right.
And I'm Ted Rawl, coming to you from the left with DMZ America, the musical.
Dun, 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 dun. Hey, by the way, we just passed 10,000 downloads of our podcast, which I know that's not, you know, Seth Rogen or whatever, it's not millions, but we're pretty happy with that, given that we decided to have a soft launch, and we did. And I think I'm pretty happy. So thank you for listening.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. It's kind of humbling.
So we had a midterm election, you may have heard, and there's a lot to unpack. And so what Ted and I are going to try and offer is a little bit different, you know, spin or skew, or what the mainstream media isn't reporting, or, you know, we're not giving you the deep dish. We're just saying here are trends that they're not showing you. So let me be the first, if I may.
Please.
The first thing that I saw, which is interesting across the country, except for very blue or very red states like Illinois, is very, 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 very blue. Obviously, Texas, very, very red. And those races went exactly as you would have expected. But in a lot of other states, there was a lot of ballot splitting. You look at the numbers and say, again, I go to the contended states like Pennsylvania, you go to Arizona, and people split their ballots. I mean, to a degree that I've never quite seen, Ted, have you? I mean, for instance, You look at, especially if you have constitutional officers, the governor of those states would get, let's say, you know, 52% of the vote. And then the Secretary of State would get 58 or 40 or 48. I mean, it was odd. People clearly were not checking that one, you know, I'm going to vote the straight Republican, or I'm the straight Democratic ticket, or the straight Libertarian ticket. I just found that the ballot splitting was really interesting. So it tells me that people were thinking a little bit out there. I mean, is that too much to hope for?
it's hard to say, right? Because, you know, whenever the biggest challenge for people like us is that we're trying to analyze the psychology of people, of a group of people, millions of people, who all have their own individual calculus for why they're doing what they're doing. And, you know, it could come down to something as silly as, I like that lady's yard signs better than I like that dude's yard signs. You just don't know. But clearly what this reflected was sort of the Elon Musk tendency. He tweeted the day before the election that, and, you know, this was misinterpreted as like just sort of a blanket, you know, admission that he's a Republican. He said, well, because the White House is under Democratic hands, he advocated people voting Republican in Congress in order to sort of balance things out and create, you know, a sort of bulwark against, I guess in this case, Democratic extremism. I think a lot of voters this was a tendency that had gone away for decades and seems to be returning. People are going more, they're choosing their candidates more a la carte than party line. So they're thinking, I mean, you know, what they're thinking and why they're thinking and how they're thinking, we don't know, but definitely they are considering each race independently rather than just going down one column. Yeah. That's clearly true.
And I think that's great. I mean, if you can give it even a modicum of thought, that's more thought than has ever been given in an American election.
Even dumb thought.
Even dumb thought.
Dumb thought is better than no thought. Well, is it? I'm not sure.
No, it's not. We've talked about this. Yeah.
But it's not.
The other takeaway here is, and it has been really remarkable here in the state of Alabama where I live, but nationally in a lot of swing states, the Libertarian Party has shown a little bit of life here. I mean, clearly, like in Georgia, the 2% that the Libertarian candidate took in the Senate race now is going to make that race go into a runoff in 4 weeks. But across the country,
what do you think is going to happen? And I want to get back to this Libertarian thing, but just parenthetically, what do you think is going to happen with in Georgia? Do you think Warnock, or I think conventional wisdom says Warnock, but I think Walker.
I think Walker is an unusual guy. And I was a fan of his, obviously, when he was, in sports. And his whole thing, his whole psychological makeup was that he would go and work his ass off. He asked his coach once, and this is a Heisman caliber running back. He asked his coach, "How can I improve?" Which is great. His coach says, "Well, you know, your endurance, maybe you may want to go and run 2 miles." Herschel Walker, called him up, or for whatever reason, looked him up a few days later, asked where he was. And he says, "Oh, he's on a 2 mile run." Herschel Walker does work hard at improving whatever thing he's doing. Apparently making babies is among them.
or paying or not to make them.
Yes. But apparently, he has become, if you've watched him over the last week, he's become a better candidate.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, of course, it was a very low bar to begin.
It was an extremely low bar. Georgia, I can't figure that one out. And by the way, Ted, how fucking tired are you and I going to get of that goddamn race? Because it's done an additional 4 weeks. It looks now that it will decide the balance of the Senate.
By the way, that Georgia law is a piece of shit. I mean, for one simple reason, is it inconveniences the voters of the state of Georgia twice. They have to go through all of this shit all over again. More TV ads, it's just dumb. I mean, I think.
If you get less than 50%, it goes to a runoff?
Yeah, it's stupid. I mean.
We have that here here in Alabama in the primaries as well as the general election.
Yeah, well, I think the idea is it's meant to tamp down what they think of as non-moderation or as extremism. But I mean, look, the person who wins the most votes should win, period. And I mean, it's like, so Georgians, I mean, here you have two candidates who are basically split by a percentage point. And now the people of Georgia have to go to the ballot, to polls again. I mean, really, what is the point of this? I mean, I don't, it's dumb. They should have declared Warnock the winner and been done.
I'm trying to think if this was applied to national politics, let's go back to 1860. Lincoln would have,
oh my God,
he would have run against Bell. I'm trying to remember who came in.
Lincoln ran against Douglas, Bell, and my personal favorite, Breckinridge.
You like him, do you?
Well, Breckinridge is an interesting character. He was the sitting vice president from 1857 to 1861. He was a Kentuckian. And when the Civil War began, he felt honor bound to support the Confederacy because he was from Kentucky. But he only did it for duty. But then he was later tried for treason. So they didn't convict, but he died disgraced and reviled. But he was, you know, he kind of really was trying to do the right thing. He's still, John C. Breckinridge is still much beloved in Kentucky. There are statues to him.
Yeah, Kentucky was a
it was a slave state.
No, but it didn't secede. Lincoln was able to keep it in the Union barely. It was a neutral state. Because you know,
it was the Switzerland of,
sure, let's call it that,
the South.
So other surprises. I mean, what do you? I mean, I think the rise of third parties. I mean, here's the thing that pisses me off. Can I go on a slight tangent, Ted, just for a second? I'm looking over the results this morning. Looking at the New York Times. Looking at CNN. Looking at those bastards couldn't even bring themselves to have photographs of the Libertarian candidates who clearly. With the exception of the fella in Georgia, whose name escapes me at the moment, but the rest of the races, they just had the Libertarian, and it would just be that gray outline, you know, online.
Like the kid in the high school yearbook who didn't join any student activities, and so it's like Bob Johnson, student, or there's no photo, like there's just like the outline of like,
yeah, that's exactly what this was. And I'm just, how hard would it have been for the news director or the interns to call up that person's campaign and say, can you send us a mugshot?
Or how about Google image search?
You can do that too. I mean, it was just so infuriating that their diminishment of third party candidates. Ted and I have talked about it a lot, and I really do believe more
especially
than ever.
Especially because they're a factor in this race. I mean, the Georgia race literally is going to a runoff because of the Libertarian. And I think Walker will get the lion's share of the percentages that will be of that 2% that hang in the balance.
But can you imagine how much I just roll my eyes at looking at a Warnock Walker runoff and just how much money is going to be wasted. I mean, how tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars are going to be poured into that.
That's true. Of course, Nevada's key too in this race. And, you know, it's weird because I used to think that the tendency was going to be for Nevada to be more purplish than Arizona. But in this cycle, it's the other way around. Arizona seems less purple. But we should, I mean, you know, I wanted to say one, you know, big takeaway for me was, you know, how exactly did the Democrats manage to, you know, not lose by as much as they thought they were going to lose, that we all thought. And I think the big answer is the Dobbs decision.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Massive. You know, Michael Moore was reviled and ridiculed for saying like that women were going to outperform expectations and voting for Democrats in this cycle. You know, how dare you tell women how to vote? Well, he didn't tell them how to vote, but he was right. 60% of voters overall told exit polls nationally yesterday that they don't favor a total abortion ban. That includes a lot of men too, obviously. But the point is, I think women, you know, politically, Republicans are not on the popular side of an issue that a lot of people care passionately about. I underestimated the importance of the overturning of Roe v. Wade politically because I thought it would excite the Republican base as much as it would infuriate the Democratic base. But that has apparently not turned out to be the case. And I think that's, you know, when the dust settles, it will be found that abortion made all the difference for Democrats in this cycle.
Yeah. Oh, no question at all. I think that there, you know, democracy in the balance had something to do with it. I mean, did their strategy of throwing tens of millions of dollars towards whack job Republicans have something to do with it? That seems less likely.
I don't know. Some of those whack job Republicans did pretty well. I mean, Oz lost. That's a shocker, by the way. We should talk about that. Oz lost.
And he lost by significant, I mean, by not substantial, but by, you know, he lost.
So I guess what it boils down to in Pennsylvania, if it comes down to an asshole carpetbagger versus a really sweet, great guy who had a stroke, we're going to go with the sweet guy.
Well, the sweet guy, people forget he had been elected lieutenant governor. So he's won statewide office there already. I mean, they know him. So, yeah. So they're going to say.
And he's quintessentially Pennsylvanian, you know.
Yeah. And he's just kind of a big, goofy guy. And but you're right. I mean, that shows.
I like his politics. I mean, if it wasn't for the stroke and if I lived in Pennsylvania, I would vote for him with great enthusiasm. He's like a Bernie guy.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have. I could have voted. I mean,
But with the stroke, I have to leave that ballot. I would have left that ballot blank.
You wouldn't have written in someone?
Well, sure, I would have.
Your cat, Clovis?
maybe. I'm not sure if elected, if he would serve or not. But he would serve ably. He would certainly be one of the best looking members of the United States Senate.
Yes. Yes, he would have.
His attendance would probably not be very, very much.
Well, here's the stuff that people aren't. And here's the stuff that people aren't thinking too much about yet, but they have to consider this. And the reason that McCarthy wanted Congressman McCarthy, who's going to be the next Speaker of the House, why he wanted a bigger margin, and why he put so much time and effort in the last 10 days of the race, which and lost, and shows you how his power of persuasion. he wanted to marginalize Marjorie Taylor Greene in that crowd. He wanted to move them aside. And so if you have a larger majority, you don't have to listen to them as closely as, say, Pelosi had to listen to, you know,
the squad,
you know, McCarthy's going to have to listen to Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's going to have more power than she should, quite frankly, because she really is nuts. So his balancing act is going to be formidable. Donald Trump now is going to probably announce his candidacy in the next few weeks.
Well, they're saying on the 15th, he's teasing an announcement on the 15th. Now, Scott, you had said, this has been your theory for quite some time, and I agreed with you, that Trump was waiting for the outcome of the midterms to use this as a way to validate his endorsements. Obviously, his endorsement didn't get Dr. Oz over the finish line. It certainly got J.D. Vance over the finish line and then some.
Yeah.
I think it turned out to be kind of a mixed bag. Obviously, Trump being Trump and politicians being politicians, he will claim that his endorsement, worked more than it didn't. Do you think that's still true, that he'll be, that would be a credible claim?
I hadn't heard, I hadn't considered that wholly until you just mentioned it, frankly, that he had some successes, clearly, but he also had some failures, Pennsylvania being among them. Arizona looks like it's holding for the Democrats there.
But not Nevada.
But not Nevada, and not Wisconsin. It looks like Johnson may be barely holding on by his fingernails.
I think Wisconsin Johnson's going to win, but we'll see.
Yeah, and which is shocking because Wisconsin's had a history of very good, solid, thoughtful, senators. William Proxmire comes to mind, and some others. But this guy, anyway, for him to win re-election,
I think Johnson's in. I mean, I'm looking right now, and you're looking at a very high. What's the percentage in? So Johnson's ahead by a point, 50.5 to 49.5 against Mandela Barnes. But this is with a. With 99% of the vote in. So
and when I went to
unless
bed,
that 1% has some massive surprise in it, sounds to me like Johnson's about to, it'll be called for Johnson.
And the, if it's 1%, I suspect it probably goes to an instant recount, but okay. Yeah. Those rarely have a significant, that big of a turnaround. And the other thing is the districts, the counties that had not been counted yet were, say it with me, kids, all rural. So
nobody lives there. Yeah.
Well, and it's going to swing red, So if you're Donald Trump, are you waking up this morning going, my endorsement was gold. It was golden.
There's got to be a little bit of an oh shit.
And he doesn't seem to have those oh shit moments. He's going to look at Ohio. Well, not within the candidate, and he's the only thing.
He also has to run because this is how he stays out of prison.
Does he? I mean, if they explain that to me, please, real quick. I'm sorry to be so dense on that. How does he stay out of prison? Because he's a candidate.
Well, because prosecutors will have to consider the fact that he's a candidate and former president. They're not supposed to really, but there's prosecutorial discretion, and it has often been decided that some politicians are better not to prosecute because it wouldn't be good for the country. It would be divisive. It could create. It could inspire political violence. And he would certainly, I think, first and foremost, none of this. Of the legal actions matters pending before him are going to come to fruition within the next year because the American legal system is a giant delaying machine. All they do is, you can file one continuance after another, a million motions, you can always stall, you can always prevent if you have enough lawyers and enough money, which Donald Trump does, you can always prevent, stave off justice, right? So he can delay, well into next year, maybe into the inauguration. It's like, really, do you want to be the prosecutor who files, I mean, I think it's badass, but do you want to be the prosecutor who files charges against a, you know, the Republican nominee for president of the United States? Really? Or even a likely Republican nominee, or even a possible Republican nominee? Do you?
Well, don't forget, I lived and worked in Chicago for years. And yeah, they did that. It happened all the time. And the guy who was under indictment usually won re-election. I mean, it's, right. Welcome to Illinois, folks. So yeah, I think you could still have that. But your point's well taken. But I don't know that, for instance, the prosecutor in there in New York is going to be persuaded by this. All of the other stuff that's coming down after from the January 6th commission. I mean, you know, Trump keeps going to the Supreme Court saying, do I have to do that? And they keep going, yeah, you do. Even this court, the one that he seems to think that the Supreme Court owes him a favor because he appointed them. I mean, he really does. It's very strange. But how does, okay, so does this change the alchemy for his announcement and for his reconsideration? I think the fact that, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, for him, he's going to announce, you know, victory in that, you know, and that old bugaboo, voter fraud, and it was a rigged election.
Right.
Lake has not said that yet in Arizona, but you know it's coming because that's how she ran on. She said on numerous sites that she would not not have certified the vote in 2020. She's not going to, and she wouldn't. And she said, they were asked her, if you lose, will you concede? And she refused to answer that.
Hey, in New York, in the New York governor's race, Lee Zeldin has not conceded.
Is that the nutbag Republican?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, he's not going to. We had a candidate here. Oh, Lindy. Oh, I can't remember her last name, here in Alabama. And she was the former. She was a total Trumpy. I mean, and like glassy eyed, non-blinking, you know, Hannibal Lecter look kind of Republican. And she was Trumpy from the very early on. And her reward for that was to be appointed American ambassador to Slovakia. And she came back here. She ran for governor. Ted, she got 12% of the vote. And she went out on election night and said, voter fraud. I won this primary.
That's a lot of fraud, man.
That's fraud on a level that you and I can only imagine. Usually I remember, what was it, Joe Kennedy said that, or was it John who was joking about his dad, said he wasn't going to pay for a landslide in Illinois.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So funny.
Yeah, it's... if you're Donald Trump, you're going to declare victory or voter fraud, you know, and election
then,
fraud.
But he's running.
Oh, God. What else has he got to do?
Right. No, that's true. Well, I mean, I guess the stakes aren't selling that well.
Yeah. Shockingly, Trump University is not, the enrollment's down.
Yeah. No, he's going to. Yeah, he'll run. So the thing is, so now we go into next year. January 1st, the new members of the new House takes over. Nancy Pelosi gives up her gavel, becomes the minority leader. So I don't know if Democrats might decide they want to have someone under the age of 100 at this. But I mean, basically, as I see it, we're just talking about gridlock, right? I mean, the House, everything the House passes, Biden vetoes. The House doesn't have enough votes to override. So that's that. Everything that, that the White House proposes, you know, doesn't get an up or down vote in the House. So it's gridlock. Nothing happens in 2023. Right. Is that basically correct?
Yeah, I would say here's my, as we said,
there might be a budget crisis.
Well, this is where I think you and I may disagree vehemently as this approaches, and that's the debt limit ceiling. McCarthy and the Republicans are saying, no more. We can't do this anymore. And you know what, Ted? They're absolutely right. You and I may disagree on this very, you know, not as passionate as sharp as disagreements on this shit ever gets. But in all seriousness, I really believe the Republicans are right. One of the factors that's driving inflation is this profligate spending by our government. And under Trump, it accelerated. It didn't decelerate. It has stayed roughly.
Wait. I gotta interrupt you. How can you say that, given the fact that deficit spending has been out of control for years?
And I'm saying that
inflation was low.
Because it eventually catches up. When over, now it's gone over. Think about this, Ted. Think about this. It's now gone over 10%. I think it's all approaching 12% of the federal budget.
That, like, the fact that McDonald's is like sells more burgers than Burger King eventually caught up and it caused inflation. I mean, there's no correlation. Much, you know, how can you point to causation?
I'm talking about because you keep printing
inflation's
money.
Been rock bottom for 40 years.
If you, I understand that, but and those of us who continue to say that if you keep spending like this, it's going to create inflation. It's going to create a terrible economy, and that day has come.
The inflation's been created by a pent up consumer demand following the COVID lockdown. That's what caused it.
No doubt, followed by supply chain issues because the manufacturers of those goods, especially in the United States, have
and the OPEC cartel.
That the gas prices certainly have something to do with it, but and the war in Ukraine, all of those are factors. But you have to cut. You have to look at if you keep pouring cash, you keep printing it to pay for your bills, and keep throwing that cash into the economy. It's going to deflate the value of that money, which will cause inflation. It's just, I mean, that's just economics 102. I mean, it's really so. What
it has more to do with money supply, but all right, let's just anyway.
Republicans, okay, no, I'm just saying, but that's going to be the big issue as soon as this Congress is seated. McCarthy's going to say no more. And you're going to
see. Okay, well, so the problem here is, look, I think personally, I can think of lots of places to cut the federal budget, starting with the Pentagon.
You and I would probably agree on that, by the way.
But there's no, but I think the problem is that you're going to the Republicans are going to precipitate a crisis if they're not willing to negotiate. I mean, you know, you're looking at, sort of. Profligate spending suddenly coming to a crashing halt. It's kind of like, we're in massive debt and suddenly we're told now you have to live within your means. Well, you just can't because you're not accustomed to it. You have to sort of adjust into it. Right. So the problem with the debt limit is it's kind of like an artificial stopgap, right? It passed, I think, in 1918. It's kind of weird because most countries don't have one. Most countries, when there's deficit spending, which is most advanced countries, they just do a budget. There's more going out than is coming in. That's it. There is a deficit. You don't need to declare it. You don't need to authorize it. It's just there. So this is meant as sort of some kind of check on that. But Congress knows what it's doing when it's voting for the budget. If Speaker McCarthy doesn't want deficit spending, then he should not sign off on a budget that has deficit spending.
No, but these guys don't. I mean, they all benefit from profligate spending. You get to get that elementary school named after you in your district. You get all the goodies and bring home the goodies if you're a good representative. And so there's something, I understand why they do it. But and the reason we have that, the debt limit is as a governor against deficit spending. It hasn't worked because they just keep passing it and keep kicking that can down the road. It's infuriating. I've talked about this before, and it's the dullest thing in the world, Ted. So go ahead and take a just lean back and relax and let the mellow sounds of Scott's economic policy. Calvin Coolidge. I was reading his biography, which was an excellent recent biography of Calvin Coolidge, believe it or not. And I think, did I send it to you?
I believe so. It is.
You haven't read it yet. Okay.
It's not yet. I'm still in the middle of Clarence Darrow.
It looks like something. Who the hell wants to know about Calvin friggin' Coolidge? It's fascinating. It really is. It's a fascinating American life. But more than that, when he was president of the United States, when he became president on the death of Warren Harding, he did something very interesting. At least for an hour, if not 90 minutes, every morning, he met with his Secretary of the Treasury, and they would go through the federal budget page by page, line by line. And everyone I tell, many people I tell that to kind of roll their eyes and say, well, I don't want my president doing that. Shit, that's all I want my president doing. They can't get into wars when they do that. they can't, there's not much mischief they can create if they're actually doing a really tight yeoman's job on controlling the budget and looking at the budget. And what that did was it allowed him to afford a tax cut. And that's, and I think that that's a reasonable and very judicious.
Yeah, as opposed to the star, the in recent years, we've had the star of the beast approach.
Yes. Yeah, like, which doesn't just, work.
Cut taxes, then the government's forced to spend less money. But obviously that hasn't happened.
No. The federal government is as big as it has ever been. It has spent as much as it has ever spent. From my perspective, that's bad. From your perspective, that's probably they're not spending enough.
Enough on the right things. I mean, I would slash the Pentagon budget by 90%. Yes. And join the rest of the world by, if we did, we'd still have the biggest defense budget in the world. Just yeah.
No, I'm thinking we could have significant cuts there, but also looking at the budgeting process in the Defense Department is just, I mean, it's ludicrous, and it's rife with corruption. It's rife with, I mean, it has overruns built into the budgets. Well, if I'm a business guy and I can make 10% more on a billion-dollar job, shit, yeah, I'm going to go, oh, golly gee.
It's a crazy thing. Like, my father was knew something about this. He was the comptroller of the Air Force, and he told me about how defense appropriations worked. Two things that are really crazy. One is if, let's say the Air Force decided one year was like, we didn't spend that much money this year. There wasn't that much going on. Then Congress would punish them by cutting their budget the following year. Well, you didn't spend all your money last year.
Yeah,
they're taking it away from you instead of being like, we'll give you the same budget, but now you'll have a little extra money to kick around and maybe you guys can get raises or whatever. Then the other thing they do is when they put out a request for a proposal to an RFP to defense contractors, you and me might say, I want to build, I want 10,000 flamethrower drones for my apocalyptic dystopian army of death. How much can I get those for? Lockheed Martin. But that's not how they do it. They call Lockheed Martin and they say, hey, we've got $250 million. What could you, how many flamethrower drones do you think you could build for that? And Lockheed Martin's like, one? And that's how you get the $800 toilet seat. I mean, I'm not even kidding. That's how they do it. They don't say, like, what's the cheapest you can do this thing that we need for? They literally issue, Congress literally gives, Northrop Grumman, we're going to give you guys X millions or billions this year. Please make some stuff for us.
That's amazing. Isn't that amazing? I mean, what a screwed up system. So yes, you and I would be on the same page. I think you can have, sober budgeting. And I think you probably find a lot of places to cut, a lot of places to save money, but you can't keep spending the way we're spending. You just can't.
All right, so let's go back to McCarthy.
So the first thing out of the chute is not going to be impeaching Biden. It's going to be a very aggressive campaign to not extend the debt ceiling.
Okay, so then the government's going to default on its debt.
And so that means government shutdown. Mm-hmm.
Degradation of the ratings on U.S. government bonds.
It also, don't forget, many of the candidates,
which would then make everything ironically cost more because the interest rates on those bonds will increase.
Yes, and you also, the national debt will increase because the percentages that we have to pay there. I was mentioning earlier, I want to finish the thought, 11 to 12% now, I think it's 11% of the national, of the federal budget is towards debt satisfaction. You have to be paying towards the interest on the debt. I mean, it's crazy.
It is crazy.
So we got to work. We got to start tamping that down. We're not going to. You're going to have a government shutdown. You're going to have cuts across the board, not anywhere where you and I would want them cut. It's going to be safety net programs. The Republicans have talked openly, which stuns me how they have any success at all at cutting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. It's going to be a mess. And I have to talk to my person because I'm 63. I wanted to wait till I was 66 and a half when I can get on Social Security, but I'm not sure that, at that point, if it's going to be viable or as viable.
Well, the question is, the thing is, okay, so the Republicans move, but like I said, Biden would veto any move to privatize or otherwise trash Social Security or Medicare, right?
Which, by the way, President W. Bush was right about wanting to have 2% of Social Security privatized. Just want to throw it out there. Another time, another discussion.
okay, definitely. Although I'm like, no, fuck that.
yeah, I loved it. We should have it.
Anyway, I think I think the thing is, it's not going to, like, they can try it. I mean, the House can definitely fuck with the debt ceiling. That's true. And they'll use it as a negotiating lever. But I think the thing is that, you know, Republicans have flirted with and done government shutdowns in the past. It has always burned them. I don't think this would be an exception. I don't think anything's changed. I think it would be, I mean, I think McCarthy knows that, I think it would be an empty bluff. I mean, if I were the Democrats, I'd call the bluff. I'd be like, fuck you. Go ahead. Do your worst, assholes.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's going to be a shutdown. You have a radical wing. And like I mentioned earlier, Marjorie Taylor Greene and that crowd are going to control a lot, are going to have much more power than expected or that McCarthy wanted. And they're going to push for radical actions like this. They, you know, they're not that smart. So they're not going to see the history of it and how this hasn't worked out well for them, because it's going to work out well for them this time. You know, it's weird, but that's how politicians often think. And that's how people think. You know, that's why, you know, they may have screwed that up, but I'm going to do it right, because I know the secret sauce, you know? And they don't. The fact of the matter is they don't. So also going forward, are you going to have Joe Biden, President Biden, reaching the hand as he said he was going to, and try to, you know, find common ground with the Republicans on some key issues? Infrastructure would be one. What other issues, Ted, would this White House and the Republicans have that they could actually see some progress on?
I think that's, maybe Ukraine, except McCarthy has said that there would no longer be a blank check for Ukraine. The brakes on spending there would probably would be applied. And, you know, you can see support for Ukraine softening, particularly among Republicans, among Republican voters. So I think that's kind of like, they could try, they might be able to do some things together there. Infrastructure is probably about it, you know, but look, if that was going to happen, that could have happened sooner. You know, it hasn't happened. So.
Right. But the Republicans were, you know, the minority party. I don't know. I don't know that they're going to all grab hands and sing Kumbaya unless there's a national emergency. Okay, one last question here is, looking forward, what does this do, if anything, to the national election in 2024? Does Joe Biden, who seems to be gearing up as much as a 90,000-year-old man can, gearing up to run for re-election? I mean, is that still a thing? I mean,
I say no fucking way. I mean, look, I mean, he's, first of all, there is going to be a Hunter Biden investigation. And as we've discussed here, there's certainly a lot of smoke and there's probably some fire there. But he's too old. He's too fucking feeble. He's too fucking old. He was too fucking old. He was too fucking feeble when he ran in the Democratic primaries last time. He's not going to be able to do it. You know, he's got to step aside in favor of Kamala. The only question here is the timing. And of course, you know, the wisdom of dutifully handing the torch has passed over to Kamala Harris, because she's only 28% of Democrats approve of her performance. Of Democrats.
Wow.
So they might just sort of rally around her the way that they rallied around Fetterman in Pennsylvania, but I'm skeptical. I mean, I think, you know, the best approach for the Democrats would be to take their thumbs off the scale, let the DNC not be involved, get rid of the superdelegates, let democracy prevail, have a wide open field. And by definition, whoever is battle tested and tempered by the primary process, by definition, will be the strongest candidate to face the Republicans in the fall of 2024. But, you know, I mean, they're not going to do that. So, I mean,
stupidity abounds. People don't let go of power that easily. And the Democratic, the DNC and those, and the big money people now involved in the DNC, which are Wall Street types. I think what you just described is what happened to the Democrats in 1972. They were very pissed off at what happened in 68 with the nomination of Hubert Humphrey, who just, the party said, oh, you had a primary system. How quaint. and then just said, it's going to be Hubert Humphrey. But he didn't win any of those. It's Hubert Humphrey. but we didn't vote for it. It's Hubert Humphrey.
Enjoy.
And so the party, there's an uprising. They took over, and the more democratically inclined took over and did exactly what you described in 72. You got, and there they got, George McGovern.
Yeah. However, you're leaving out the small matter of what happened to Edmund Muskie and how he was the strongest candidate, and Nixon's bagmen, his dirty tricksters, got rid of Muskie. In early on in the primaries, right?
Well, through dirty tricks. And let's also not forget that George Wallace was doing quite well in the Democratic primary. In fact, a few days before he was shot, had just won the Florida primary and was campaigning in Maryland and looked to be winning that one. He could have actually been the nominee, which would have been.
That's insane.
What a difference. You know, well, you have a choice between George McGovern or George Wallace.
Don't forget also, McGovern got hosed from the Thomas Eagleton affair, right? Which sounds like the name of a 1973 rom-com or starring Steve McQueen. But it's definitely, yeah. I mean,
the Eagleton affair, it's electric. For those of you who have absolutely no idea what we're talking about, the original running mate was Eagleton, who was a senator from Maryland. Where was he from? Holy crap.
I was gonna say Missouri. I thought Missouri.
But he had suffered some depression and had gone through electroshock therapy in the 60s. And electroshock therapy, which was common practice back then.
It's Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Thank you. God. Anyway, so McGovern said, I made the huge mistake. Actually, it wasn't a mistake. He should have stuck to it, of saying he's behind Eagleton 1,000%.
Oops.
And then a week or 10 days later, dropped him from the ticket in favor of Sergeant Shriver.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, I think McGovern was going to lose no matter what. But the point is, man, he had a lot going against him. He also ran a terrible campaign.
No, and he was, yeah. I mean, and there was a lot of policies he put forward.
They literally he was a World War II hero.
Yeah.
And they made him out like a big wuss. They kind of swift boated him.
They did swift boat him. And you know, given that Nixon, the guy he was running against, played poker in the Pacific and for 4 years, was pretty much his service.
Yeah. Well, it's like Reagan, you know, who served in Hollywood.
He was a Carson City Commando. That's what they call him.
It's so hilarious.
So going forward, I mean, so yeah. So does Trump announce now again? Yeah, he does.
Yes.
Of course he does. Of course he does. And that changes the landscape. I mean, it really does. Although, have you watched his last couple of performances?
No, I have not.
They've been less than stellar. They've been even more stumbly bumbly, clearly talking off the top of his head. But what is he now? He's 76, 77. I mean, he's not that yet. He's an old man. Not in, you know, obviously hasn't taken care of himself. So, you know, you got to kind of wonder about where, if you had a young, vibrant candidate running against him, and you know who is getting a lot of talk, and you're going to roll your eyes, Ted. So go ahead and do it now. Just roll your eyes. Let's see it. Okay. For those of you who can't hear it, he just rolled his eyes. Pete Buttigieg is getting a lot. People are really talking about him a lot. They're very impressed.
He's certainly more impressed. He is certainly more impressive than Kamala Harris. And
yes.
he got a lot more votes than she did in the Democratic primaries.
And Democrats and Republicans are both.
And you know, he's hating on the airlines. And who doesn't like that?
And I think you and I had Toby Kemp, who's a railroad worker, on this show recently. And that has yet to be resolved. If that union votes to strike, you're going to have Joe Biden stepping up and saying, no, you cannot strike. He's really going to slap the face of organized labor in this country by instituting that rule and denying the right of railroad workers to strike. Now railroad workers have an option. They can just say, screw you, we're going to stay out. Or,
I mean, it's not like they're going to be sent to prison, but I mean.
Yeah, they can be. According to the law as it stands, they can be. So,
but they're not really going to do that.
Yeah. So my point is that Buttigieg is going to be a big part of that story. And if he's viewed as being anti, anti-union. I think that hurts, obviously, his chances of getting the nomination in 2024. But Democrats and Republicans are really impressed by the job he's doing as Secretary of the Treasury. I mean, of Transportation.
Transportation. Well, don't forget, we weren't that impressed when he took paternity leave for 6 months when he first became, when he first got into the cabinet. But he's doing a better job now. He's more visible. And like I said, he imposed some rules on the airlines, who are, you know, basically the most hated industry in America after perhaps cable TV and health insurance and attorneys. So
and newspapers.
Yeah. And well, yeah, and newspapers and Congress. Congress has like a 10% approval rating.
So going forward, I mean, if Biden, would he take a step back and endorse Kamala? Does he have, I guess he doesn't have a choice, but I'm thinking back in 88, did Reagan endorse Bush in the primaries? Do you remember? I don't think he did. Ooh, I think he said, my party has to make that decision. Well, that my party has maybe, to make that decision.
You know, I think, and frankly, I think that's correct. I thought it was wrong for Obama to weigh in on the 2016 primaries. I thought it was, that should not have happened. I think this, you know, the outgoing president should be an éminence grise who is above and who allows the party to decide what direction it wants to go in next.
Well, there it is. Our predictions, such as they are, such as they're worth.
Yes, today, not a lot.
Not a whole lot. Well, no. We'll be talking about this. And in fact, we'll probably knock out another pod later in the week just to, as we get, as the numbers come rolling in and we get a clearer picture of what's going on. Haven't had an election deniers like Kelly out in, not Kelly. All of a sudden I can't remember the, hold on. In Arizona, the lake. She's going to scream. That's really tightened up. Holy crap. I'm just looking at it now, Ted. Holy Mary. That's far less. That's 0.6% as separates Hobbs from Lake now.
How much of the vote is in?
Wow, if that's correct, and this is coming from the
Arizona
Republic.
You've only got 66%. Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of room to wiggle there. When you have a point spread of 0.8%, less than a single point, and only 2/3 of the vote in, statistically, it's still possible for it to go either way.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's going to be interesting to watch that over the next 24 or 48 hours. So, and we will definitely be paying attention to that because that's what you pay us for. We watch these things so you don't have to.
Exactly. And then you listen to us and then it's like you watched it, but through your ear. What? I don't know. I need more coffee.
More coffee. Okay, Ted, so before we sign off, where can we see your fabulous work?
Well, my fabulous work, I don't know, but you can see my actual work at rall.com, RALL.com. And just a pitch to consider purchasing my most recent graphic novel called The Stringer, co-authored with Pablo J. Callejo. And also you can check me out at whowhatwhy.org.
Cool. And you can see me at gocomics.com/Scott Stantis, gocomics.com/Prickly City. You can go to chicagotribune.com/opinions to the gallery of the work I do for them. Go to Dallas Morning News or dallasnewsrather.com/opinion and go see my work I do for them. You can go to 1819 News and see the work I do for them. I mean, I'm just working all over the place, but I want to throw in a clip. I'm about to join Ted Rall on a new thing called Counterclip. And it's an exciting new app. It's going
center,
to be
center clip, Scott.
Center clip. What did I say?
Counter clip.
I'm an idiot.
We're also in counterpoint. So between
we are.
Center clip and counterpoint, it could be confusing.
So center clip, it's an app. You need to check it out. It's where commentators will give real-time audio commentary. Up here's, well, I'm just actually turned it on and I didn't mean to. So stop. Stop. God, be older, Scott. Jesus, this damn phone. Anyway, so Ted and I are joining it. We're going to have a conversation, live conversations. We post there, so give it a center clip.
It's a micro podcast. It's kind of
Yeah, it's a very cool idea, very new. So I'm going to be joining it shortly, and Ted's already on it, giving his expert commentary, which is excellent, as you might think, I think.
I do. And I'm looking forward to you coming on board. I know it's just a matter of hours or days.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to that. So let's see. Can we make it? You had a really cool announcement about the Stringer. Can we talk about it now, or do you want to wait?
Oh no, we cannot talk about that. Just to say, there's good news.
Okay.
And
we like good news. Yeah. We like good news. So for Ted.
Actually,
Rollins,
I'm sorry. It's not about the Stringer. It's about a previous book of mine. The Stringer has no good news. Nothing but bleak, horrible news.
Unless you buy it, and you know you should.
That's right. No, there's good news about a previous title of mine, also co-authored with Pablo, called The Year of Loving Dangerously. And people who are smart about graphic novels can probably guess what kind of news that would be. But I'm going to make them guess because, you know, why not?
Okay. Well, all right. And by the way, the book is really interesting to read. And I love Ted's work, obviously. So, because I love Ted. But anyway, okay. So until next time, I'm Scott Stannis coming to you from the right.
And I'm Ted Rawl coming to you from the left.
Until next time, au revoir.
Au revoir.